Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the founder and editor of the New Books Network. I've published several academic books, and one of the things I found frustrating is my inability to get them picked up in the press. There really is no PR service specifically oriented toward academic books. Recently, however, I had the opportunity to work with a PR firm in New York, RLM, on a book that I recently published. And I have to say, they did a remarkable job at a very low price. And this got me thinking, I wonder if the New Books Network and RLM could provide a service that would promote academic books. So the folks at RLM and I put our heads together and we came up with a package. It is specifically targeted toward people like you, people who write academic books. So if you're interested, you should go to the NBN website and click publish your book, and there you'll find some information about the services that the NBN and RLM are offering. What we really want to do is provide you with value for money. As far as we know, no such service exists. This is the first of its kind, and we really hope it is successful, and we hope that it helps you get the word out about your academic book.
Welcome to the New Books Network.
Hello, welcome to New Books in Music, a channel on the New Books Network. My name is Kristen Turner, and today I'm talking to Catherine Preston, author of the first biography of George Frederick Bristow, published by University of Illinois Press in 2020. Bristow has largely been forgotten today, but he was a significant figure in the music scene of 19th century New York City. Born in 1825, Bristow led a professional life that today's musicians would surely recognize. He patched together a living from performing, composing, conducting, teaching, church jobs, and even some business ventures and celebrity endorsements. Preston situates his life within the booming musical economy in New York and his music within the critical and artistic currents of the 19th century. At his death in 1898, he left behind a large body of compositions in every popular genre of the period, including a number of symphonies and Rip Van Winkle, the first grand opera by an American composer. Like just about every 19th century American composer, however, Bristow's music is rarely performed, but perhaps this book will stimulate interest in his work and that of his contemporaries. Thank you for joining me today, Kitty. It's great to talk to you a second time. I've interviewed you before about your amazing Opera for the People book, but this is a quite a different project, a first biography, I think, for you. So congratulations and welcome to New Books in Music.
Thank you for having me, Kristen. This is a delight. I enjoyed the other interview as well, and I'm looking forward to this one. And yes, this is quite a different project, not just because it is a biography as opposed to a cultural history, but because it is it's relatively short compared to the Opera for the People book, which is clocks in at about 600 pages. This is much shorter because it fits in a particular series. It's about 200 pages or so. So it's more easily consumable on a casual read than Opera for the People, which it takes a while to get through that. So anyway, so yes, and the other thing I should mention is that when I first started working on this project, I was having a conversation with Laurie Matheson in Charleston, actually, at a conference of the Society for American Music. And I pointed out to her that the wonderful series, American Composer Series, that University of Illinois Press does, at the time had, I think, 12 imprints, 12 books, one of which was about an American composer of the 19th century. And I pointed out that that is a serious lacking in terms of coverage of musical history of the 19th century, and that maybe George Bristow would be a good candidate, and I volunteered at that point to write a biography of George Bristow, because I had actually several years before published an edition of his Second Symphony, which is part of the Music of the United States series, and I wrote a large introduction, I think a 100-page introduction, about that symphony, about symphonic music in 19th century America, and about George Bristow, because at that time there was nothing in the historiography that could put this symphony in context. So when I spoke with Laurie about this, I thought, well, he's not the most interesting guy, you know. If you look at the history books, he's portrayed as this kind of stodgy, reactionary, conservative composer, and we didn't know much about him in terms of his life. So that image, coupled with the few visual images of him, kind of reinforced this idea that he was kind of boring. So I was doing this a little bit reluctantly, but then I started reading the journals, the music journals of the 19th century and newspaper reports and so forth. I had a whole year as on sabbatical, my last year at the College of William and Mary before I retired, and I spent that year just doing additional research beyond what I had used for the introduction to the symphony. And I discovered that this guy was considered by his colleagues to be the most important American classical composer in the 1860s, 70s, and into the 80s. And I thought, whoa, we don't know anything about this man. We know a little bit about him in the history books, but the portrayal is all wrong. He actually comes across as a very interesting, kind, supportive, proselytizing for American music, but also proselytizing for music as an important part of American life. Generous, and actually with a droll sense of humor, a guy who was actually somebody I think I would have liked to know, which is entirely different than the kind of image that I had learned about him as a student and as a scholar working on 19th century music. So once I got into the project, I was quite excited about it, and I think it shows in my enthusiasm in the writing. I hope so, anyway.
Oh, yeah, absolutely. I think it does show through. And actually, you've answered some of my first questions that I already had. But to pick up on your point about how Bristow has this reputation of being kind of a stick in the mud and stuff, I think maybe we can start with the one period or one aspect of his life that if you know about 19th century American music, you've probably heard of Bristow, and that is he was involved in this big conversation in 1854 about American music versus and the lack of support of American music by American institutions in New York, institutions of music, of course. Can you talk a little bit about that particular moment and how that has affected our idea of Bristow, and then how you think that might have been incorrect, I guess, is your point.
Well, okay, that's a big question.
That's a big question. I know. We'll just start with the big one.
It's the most important probably the one most important question about Bristow, because it's the only part of Bristow that anybody knows about. And I'm talking about Americanist music historians who know about it. Most music historians don't know anything about American music, period, much less something in the 19th century. In 1853, let's see, how much detail do I want to go into? In 1853, late 1853, a renowned virtuoso conductor named Louis Julien, who was working in London as part of the Proms concerts, what became the Proms concerts, pop music concerts, came to the United States with a group of about 27 or 28 musicians, many of whom were the star virtuosi of Europe. And he was able to lure these people over because he paid well. All right, so he came to the United States in August, to New York, 1853. And set about doing one concert every day for weeks in New York City, attracting lots of people. He lured a number of the New York Philharmonic Society orchestra musicians into his orchestra. So he had an orchestra of 100 musicians, and it blew the Philharmonic Society of New York out of the water. Okay, so that's kind of the background. He also started to commission works by American composers who were living in New York. The two most prominent of them were William Henry Fry, a Philadelphia composer who now was living in New York. He was a journalist as well, worked for the New York Tribune, and George Bristow, who at the time was a rising star in New York. Okay, so Bristow wrote Symphony No. 2, which is subtitled the Julien Symphony. And Fry wrote a number of pieces, including the Santa Claus Symphony and a lot of overtures and so forth. And Julien actually performed them. Okay. Now, the background to that is that for about 10 years before that, American composers, especially in New York, had been kind of fighting with the Philharmonic Society, which was founded in 1842. It, at the time, was the only standing orchestra in America. Because over the years of the 1840s, the orchestra composition had been changed because of the influx of a lot of German musicians from revolutionary Germany who were coming to this country to avoid all what was going on in Germany. And they brought with them their love of German music. And so increasingly over the 1840s, the Philharmonic Society of New York performed more and more European music to the exclusion of anything that was being written in the United States. Now, most composers in the United States realized that, of course, we are part of the Western European cultural sphere, so we need to learn this music. We want to listen to Beethoven, we want to listen to Mendelssohn and Spohr and so forth. But do we have to listen to all these other third-rate composers like Kalevoda and Marschner and so forth? I don't want to insult any Kalevoda or Marschner scholars, but, you know, the idea was we can write music that maybe is not, you know, the best, but it is, we're learning and we're trying to create a musical culture. And so there would be letters to the editor in like the Message Bird or the New York Musical Journal or editorials by in musical journals about what about, you know, what is one thing that is part of the charter of the Philharmonic Society to promote creation of music in New York. Okay, so here comes Julianne into the middle of this kind of not so happy contretemps between composers and musicians and the Philharmonic Society, of which George Bristow is a charter member and a very important member. And the fact that Julianne was actually performing these pieces made the American composers go, oh, maybe my music is okay. Maybe it's worthy of composing. Maybe what we're hearing from the Philharmonic Society, which is, well, when your music is good enough, we'll play it. Maybe they're wrong, all right? And at the same time, we have somebody like Fry, who had just spent the previous 6 years as a correspondent to the Tribune in Paris, listening to all sorts of music. So he knew what the general standard of orchestral music was in Western Europe. And so he's coming back. He had come back just the previous year. And he's going, excuse me, this is a lot of malarkey that you're telling us our music isn't good enough. So in 1853, Julianne is performing pieces, and one of the pieces that he performs is one of the movements from Bristow's first symphony, and a movement from the symphony that he had commissioned, the second symphony. And he programs some pieces by Fry, including something called the Santa Claus Symphony. And the Santa Claus Symphony is basically a big tone poem. And he played it on Christmas Eve, right? The concert was on Christmas Eve. So perfectly legitimate time. Well, one of the critics, Richard Storrs Willis, wrote a review of that concert in which he's praising Bristow's symphony and he dismisses the Christmas Symphony. He says, our good friend, William Fry, he just wrote this trifle of a piece and he's calling it a symphony. You know, symphonies are like four movements long. And the first movement is, he doesn't say sonata allegro because the term hadn't been invented, but you know, we have like exposition. And so anyway, so this was really a smackdown for William Henry Fry. And Fry went ballistic. And he's a journalist. And he wrote to Richard Storrs Willis a letter to the editor. Long. I mean, Fry was verbose. And he wrote a letter saying, excuse me, it is the responsibility of American critics to support American composers and the responsibility of the Philharmonic Society. And they went back and forth a couple times with rebuttals and more letters and rebuttals. And meanwhile, Bristow's on the side. And then Willis makes a fatal mistake, which is to bring in the New York Philharmonic Society, because Fry had said something like, you know, a good example of our lack of support is the Philharmonic Society and their programs and the lack of support for American composers. And Willis, who tended to lecture, and he was lecturing American composers, and he said, well, your good friend Bristow he is on the board of the Philharmonic Society. And if this was in fact true, he would say something, at which point Bristow, who took this as kind of throwing down the gauntlet, logged on in a 20th or 19th century way and wrote a letter, and he said, "Excuse me, my dear Mr. Willis, but you are wrong, and Mr. Fry is completely right." And he went on about the German hegemony and, you know, the fact that the Germans are a clique and so on and so forth. And this goes back and forth for a number of times. And the Philharmonic Society weighs in, and they say, "Oh, we can give a whole list of all the American composers, the American compositions we've performed over the last 10 years, which consisted of about 10, and two of them were by Bristow, and the other ones were by visiting composers from Europe. They weren't Americans and so forth." So it was just utter nonsense. Anyway, it just kind of blew up into what is called by some scholars as the musical battle of the century. And so, and Bristow, who is staunchly defending American composers, got this reputation as being this this reactionary against what the New York Philharmonic Society was doing. And it then colored his reputation for the rest of, you know, until today. Because that's all people know about George Bristow. Now, one thing that is that I think I change in this book is the fact that if you look at information on Bristow in biographical dictionaries or in histories of American music, you will see people saying, "Well, Bristow, I mean, he talked a good talk, but his music, he wrote classical style absolute music. His Second Symphony is four movements, Sonata Allegro, Theme and Variations. It's old-fashioned, early Romantic period music. So, you know, who's he lecturing us about creating an American musical style?" But in reality, if you look at his music, he wrote quite a few pieces that are very much overtly Americanist in orientation and nationalist in orientation, including Rip Van Winkle, which was, as you mentioned, is an important opera. He wrote several of his symphonies, one called The Acadian, which is about pioneers going west and has an Indianist movement. He wrote the Niagara Symphony. He wrote an ode called the Grand Republic, and so forth. So his music reflects his belief that American composers should be supported, and American music should be supported. That's a very long answer. I'm sorry.
No, that's exactly what I hoped you'd say, because, you know, people aren't going to, listeners might not know all of that. So that's good that you gave all that background. And actually, do you think, so I guess the upshot of that was, even though they had all this discussion about it, German music really did dominate, particularly in instrumental music, for a long time. I mean, it wasn't like suddenly they were all like, "Oh, we need to support American composers." That is not what happened. So do you think there was any, what do you think the result was long term of that battle? Do you think, you know, did it change anything? I mean, I'm just wondering kind of what the upshot was.
As we know from Doug Shadle's book on the orchestra in the 19th century, it didn't much change anything. In fact, there was not an American conductor of the Philharmonic Society for the rest of the century. I should know when the first American conductor of the Philharmonic Society was. Theodore Thomas conducted the Philharmonic Society. He was a German immigrant. And he has a reputation of supporting American music, but in fact, he did not. There's so much misinformation about the support or lack of it of American composers, and just knowledge about American composers and knowledge of American compositions in the 19th century, that it is really hard to say, at least from my point of view, what impact Bristow and his proselytizing for American composers had on American culture, except for the fact that he was there as a constant voice, a revered and very well respected composer for the next 50 years. I can't imagine how he did not have an impact on the development of American composition, whether it was orchestra music or other music, during this time, because he was there as someone who had succeeded at the Europeans' game. He wrote their their forms. He wrote oratorios. He wrote a mass. He wrote five symphonies. He wrote overtures. He wrote piano music and choral music and so on and so forth. And he did it very well, to the extent that actually Louis Julien took the symphony back to Europe and played it in Europe, and to great acclaim. But there just wasn't this sense of supporting new music in this country, except if it was written by Europeans. I can't imagine that it did not have some kind of impact, but it did not. It was not revolutionary, and the Philharmonic Society. I mean, actually, Bristow actually up and quit Phil. He quit for about five concerts, and then the Philharmonic Society. I guess they maybe extended an olive branch and said, "We'll come back," because it was a little embarrassing that the most prominent American composer and a really good violinist who had been with the Philharmonic Society since its beginning, which is something I can talk about as well, was now out of the orchestra entirely. He had been on the board, and he finally came back. And I don't have any documentation for this, but I think they lured him back by promising to perform his Julien Symphony, which they did in 1856. They performed it, and they put it on the shelf, and they completely forgot about it for the rest of it. And that was the way the musicians of the Philharmonic Society and the directors, the conductors, and so forth, that's how they dealt with American music. It was very difficult for American composers to get started. But, you know, many of them did continue. They persisted, to use their wonderful wonderful expression. They persisted, and now we're trying to dig up the music that they created, and are finding that there's some really good music out there that was ignored by, you know, oratorio performers or choral societies, opera companies, symphonies. I mean, the Julien Symphony and his third symphony, have both been recorded now from modern orchestras, and they're good recordings. And actually, people occasionally hear them on the radio. So I'm hoping that there will be more and more of this kind of rejuvenation of the music to get into our sonic ears and our soundscape, so that people really understand that America has a really strong musical background in the 19th century that we know nothing about. And that's to our shame that we know nothing about it, or very little about it.
Well, I think you can argue that really nothing much has changed even up until today. I mean, when Maren Alsop is going to leave the Baltimore Symphony soon, and when she does, there will be no American-born conductors of any American orchestras in the United States. And so this sort of idea of, even though, of course, we have many prominent 20th and 21st century composers now, you still look at what people program, and it's particularly, of course, as you say, from the 19th century, but even in the 20th century, it's so dominated by European composers. So I'm not sure that all that much, I mean, things have changed, but certainly I feel like you can see that long tale of history, so to speak, where you start with not really valuing American compositions in the 19th century, and that sort of still lives on today, where we still look to Europe for so much of our repertoire and our leaders. Just, yeah.
Yeah. It's not just repertoire. I mean, when people ask me, say I'm on a bike ride because I'm an avid cyclist, you know, I'm asked me, well, what do you do? Well, I teach American music, or I have taught, I teach music history. I'm a music historian. And I just finished a book about a composer, a 19th century composer. I write about American musical life of the 19th century. And most people haven't a clue. They maybe can name Stephen Foster. Maybe. They can certainly name Stephen Foster if I say, I come from Alabama with my banjo on my knee, because they know the tune, but they don't know anything about him. But as far as knowing anything about our own cultural history, it's pretty slim pickings in terms of what people know. And I think it's a fascinating story that is part of our own culture. And I tend to get on a soapbox and talk about these types of things, because I think it's important for us as Americans to know what our own cultural and social history is all about.
Well, let's try to remedy that a little bit by, let me ask you a question about that. So can you maybe take the view of Bristow in, 1897, and if you were to be looking back over this long career he had, what sort of, what was the musical culture that he lived through? How did it change and develop over the course of his career, which really lasted for, from the 40s until the late 90s? I mean, he died sitting in a classroom when he was about to teach. So he did not retire. He worked literally until the moment of his death. So, what went on in that period? Tell us about American cultural life.
Oh, wow. Another big question. All right. Well, it has a lot to do with how Bristow is remembered today. What we have in the United States in the 1850s, which is when Bristow is coming of age as a musician, gaining his reputation, increasing numbers of touring musicians are coming to the United States. There's a brief touring musicians from Europe, of course, including orchestras and chamber musicians and lots of singers and lots of opera companies. So there is an burgeoning American musical culture. The cultural life of the country is actually quite rich. There's a brief hiatus in the first year of the Civil War when everybody went, oh my God, what's going to happen? What are we going to do? And after that, things kind of settled down and the opera company started touring again and the musicians in America toured around. That cut off, the war years cut off much interaction between Europe because musicians didn't want to come over to this country during a war, after the war, in the years 65 through about 73, there was an absolute explosion of entertainment because people who now were post-war, many of them had traveled for the first time. They were in the military. They went elsewhere. They got off their farms. They went out of their own hometowns and they traveled around. And now they went back home and they were ravenous for entertainment. And there was also an economic boom because of the post-war expansion of the railroads and increased borrowing. The United States borrowed lots of money from Europe, both for reconstruction in the South and also for building the railroads. And people had lots of extra money and extra time, and the middle class was growing, and the cities were expanding, and the West was growing. So cities like Omaha and Denver were going from nothing to huge, large metropoli. Anyway, So in this this culture, we have increasing numbers of Europeans coming over again because now the war was over, and we have people who are now becoming acquainted with orchestra music and band music, and lots of sheet music is floating around and so forth. So that's kind of popular music. Things start to change in a lot of ways. They accelerate, I guess. So from the 70s, 80s into the 90s, Americans become more Eurocentric in terms of culture. And the idea of having to have the imprimatur of Europe in order to succeed in the United States became kind of de rigueur. So we have in the 70s, all of these young women going to Europe to learn how to be prima donnas. And all of these young students of piano, Louis Gottschalk. Actually, he went before that. He went in the 50s to Europe. But by the 70s and the 80s, you have to go to Europe to get musical training because there weren't really any musical conservatories operating, essentially, in the United States. So they bring back not only the imprint that, okay, we're okay because we succeeded in Europe, but also a taste for European classical standard canonical music. And so, and then all of these other touring performers, the best singers active on the operatic stage in Europe, the best performers, some of the best composers came over to this country, visiting America and bringing their music with them. So by the 80s, there is this sense that America is just an outpost of Europe. And so it's very, very increasingly Eurocentric. On top of that, in the operatic world, there is the idea that opera should no longer be a entertainment. It should not be popular culture. It should be uplifting, and it should be edifying. And that is the influence of Richard Wagner. The influence he had was on a bunch of the critics in New York and in Chicago and in other major cities who became self-proclaimed Wagnerites. And so they spent their time trying to teach Americans what was good music. And good music was European music in opera. It wasn't Italian opera anymore. It was German opera, because that was uplifting and edifying and so on and so forth. So by the 90s, there is a fairly large enclave of critics who are proselytizing for German music, especially in the opera world, but also Beethoven and, you know, and Raff and you know, some French composers, but it's mostly the German, Austro-German heritage. Bristow, meanwhile, is chugging along, teaching his music. He taught privately. He taught in the New York City school system from 1854 to 1898, teaching kids this music. He's teaching Beethoven, and he's teaching, you know, Handel, oratorio stuff, and so forth. But he's still, at the same time, supporting American composers. He had a fight with the Philharmonic Society at one point. This is in the 1870s or 80s. I can't remember exactly when it was, when they had hired an American pianist to do solo, and a European pianist shows up in New York, and they told the American pianist, "I'm sorry, your contract is null and void. We're going to feature this European pianist." And Bristow went ballistic and said, "You can't do this. This is not right." He also was in charge of the Harmonic Society and several other choral societies in New York, and he regularly programmed things like Handel and Mendelssohn, but he also programmed Dudley Buck and other American composers, including his own. In the 90s, he joined the Manuscript Society, the goal of which was to perform music by American composers. So throughout his entire life, he is programming music by Americans. He's an organist in a choir directors in churches, so he's playing American music. He's keeping it alive, and he's writing music that celebrates American nationalism. I mentioned a number of pieces before. By the 90s, or by the, I guess maybe the late 80s and into the 90s, he is still considered a venerable composer by many in America, but he never went to Europe to study. So he doesn't have that stamp of excellence from the Europeans, although he studied with European composers in America, but he never went there. He never felt the need to go there. All of the composers, I'm broadly generalizing, but a majority of the young American composers of the coming up in the 70s, 80s, they went to Europe. McDowell went to Europe. Chadwick went to Europe. People who become very popular and important in the 90s. They all went to Europe, and Dudley Buck went to Europe. And he was an organist in New York. We think about Dudley Buck. We know Dudley Buck. He's got a reputation in part because he had that imprimatur from Europe. He was working as an organist in New York the same time Bristow was. People don't know about Bristow, they know about Dudley Buck. So by the 80s, late 80s and into the 90s, Bristow has kind of faded away because he doesn't have that cachet from Europe, and because he's still writing music that people consider old-fashioned. They still consider him to be really important and venerable, and Bristow just keeps chugging along, and he's still playing the organ. He's one of the best organists in New York, and he's still writing music and so forth. But he's not in the forefront anymore, in part because he's not a Wagnerian. He's a Beethovenian. He loves Beethoven, and he proselytizes for the early Romantic style. He did write some program music, but he was primarily a composer. In his later symphonies, he utilized programmatic techniques, so he wasn't behind the times. He just had this reputation of being an old-fashioned, fuddy-duddy guy. He's still teaching, he's still playing the organ, he's still composing, but he's not cutting edge anymore. And so many of the early histories of American music were written by Louis Ellison and people who came up during that period. And by that time, Bristow was kind of, he was around still, but he was kind of a faded memory in the memory of a lot of people. So he doesn't make it into those early histories very well. Does that help?
Yes, no, that was a great answer. And it, one of the things I liked about what you were saying is it really shows how Bristow was involved in sort of every aspect of musical life in New York. You know, he was charter member of major New York institutions. He was conducting orchestras and choral groups, plus his church work, plus the education work. I mean, it seemed like there wasn't an aspect of musical life in New York that Bristow wasn't involved in a very deep way. It wasn't like he'd be there for a year and he was gone. He was involved with these institutions for decades in some cases. Do you have a sense, after doing all this work, do you think there was one element of his career that was more important to him, that was sort of his first priority over others? You know, I was really struck by just how incredibly busy the man must have been.
on top of the busyness of all the activity, all the productivity, think about what he was doing. He was commuting from Morrisania, which was Westchester County, which is now the Bronx, down to Lower East Side Manhattan to teach elementary school every day. And I spent a fair amount of time trying to figure out how did he get from point A to point B. And it's, you know, you think in a city like New York, you'd be able to find that stuff out. You'd be able to look to, go to the New York Historical Society and find a book on railroads or find a book on, you know, transportation in New York. Oh my God, he must have spent hours.
I thought of that too, just the commuting time. You know, you wonder if he had a pied a terre in Manhattan or something.
And I think he may have, but I couldn't find it. Again, I mean, the kind of nitty-gritty stuff that you try to come up with in order to make a person come alive is almost impossible to find. I mean, I did spent a lot of time looking at city directories to see where, you know, he lived, where he was growing up, you know, when the family was in Brooklyn, when it was in lower, you know, in lower Manhattan and so forth. And it is, it's incredible.
That does bring up the question about what were the documents that you had for his life? Like, you know, you just spoke of how hard it was to kind of bring him to life as a person. Why was that?
Okay. Can I put that question on hold for just a second? Sure. Go back and answer your other question.
Oh, yes, absolutely. First, sorry. Go ahead.
That's all right. What was most important to him? It's hard. It's hard to determine that because the guy was a prolific composer. He started composing at 14. The first piece he wrote that got published was when he was 14 years old. And it was a piano piece, you know, a dance piece or something. And the last piece he wrote was the Niagara Symphony, which he wrote in 1893. And he conducted in 1898. In April 1898, he died in December. So he was active as a composer his entire life. that was important to him. Conducting was important to him because he conducted all those choral groups and he was a church music person. One of the things that kind of goes throughout his entire career, however, his support for American composers, his support for music as an important human activity, and connecting all of that is his interest in educating. He wrote this autobiography. I'll get to the autobiographical thing in a minute, but he wrote this autobiographical sketch when he was in the 1860s, when he was in his 40s, mid-30s. And he says in that, he talks in that about how he starts teaching. And when he starts teaching, he is this young, hotshot piano player. I mean, the guy must have been a spectacular pianist because I've looked at some of his piano music, which are supposed to be character pieces, right? That you can, you know, learn pretty simply. Oh my God, they tend to have stretches of a tenth in the right hand and the melody is in the middle voice. And it's a, you know, it's like, he must have had huge hands. But when he started to teach, he would teach trying to get people to play that kind of stuff. And then at one point he did a concert, lots of these pieces that he'd written, and he did some other stuff. And someone came up to him after, you know, it's stuff like Gottschalk's music, which was popular-ish. He thought of it as popular music. And someone came up to him afterwards and said, well, when are you going to play some popular music? And it was like, I thought I just played a whole concert of popular music. But he realized at that point that there was a difference in flavor between Carry Me Back to Old Virginia is a tune that he mentions, Which is not the Bland, not the James Bland State Song Emeritus of Virginia, but an earlier version of Carry Me Back to Old Virginia, which made him think, oh my God, there's a difference in flavor here. And at the same time, he was trying to build up a group of students, a studio of students teaching private piano. And he actually said, I realized I had a hard time getting students and keeping students. And this other guy over here who's just like a hack, he's got more students than he knows what to do with. I realized, I'm speaking for him, that I had to be kind. And I had to lower my expectations, not down to nothing, but make it fun for people. Because music is important. And I want people, even young, you know, young men who are playing pool or whatever, they would be much better if they would spend time learning an instrument. And he says that in his autobiographical sketch. So then he completely changed his way of teaching, and he became an understanding taskmaster, but an understanding and kind teacher, not just in teaching lessons like organ or piano, but also in teaching elementary school kids. And the results he had from these students, be like, these are like first and second and third graders, and they were doing this incredible concerts at the end of the year that was like some Handel aria, or Handel stuff from oratorios, and it's like, and there's, I mean, I've read descriptions of these the kids who are dressed up and they're on stage and they're doing it all for their parents, and it's the end of the year kind of big concert. And at the end of the concert, they all stand there very quietly until their parents come up and fetch them. these are like 7 and 8 year old kids. It's amazing. But he had that. He was an effective enough teacher, and he believed strongly enough in the importance of music that he could do that. He could get results. So I didn't really answer your question, except that all of it is kind of wrapped up together. I mean, I think it was pretty amazing guy.
Well, the accounts you give of his teaching are just amazing. 100 kids in a room, you know, teaching them this really complicated, hard music. I can't even really imagine, you know, and then to have the idea of the quintessential end of year concert. Boy, that started a long time ago, right? So that was really fun. So what sort of, you know, you've talked a lot about newspaper articles that you've read. I mean, is that basically your documentation from Bristow is his life in the press?
Well, the majority of it is, which is a little discouraging, because I really wanted to put flesh on the bones of this person that we all sort of know about. We have this two-dimensional image. I started out the research building on what I had accumulated for the introduction to the Bristow, the Julian Symphony. But I had focused on that one basically in the 1850s and earlier, because that symphony dates from 53. I didn't do a whole lot in that introduction with his later career. So I had to go back and do a lot of research. The research I started with was newspaper research. And now that so many newspapers are online and they're digitized, and you can do searches using Bristow and George Bristow and G.F. Bristow and G. Bristow, you know, and all these various different kinds of search terms. And also, if I know the Philharmonic Society and the Harmonic Society, look up places, organizations he worked with. And I amassed a huge database full of material about Bristow, which included things like all of the benefit concerts he played in, all the gigging things he did, in addition to his regular work as a performer in an orchestra or a conductor or an organist in a church. He also was doing lots and lots of what I call gigging musicians, working for benefit concerts or working for special events and so on and so forth. So a lot of information is from there. There is two really useful print documents that I found. One of them I found fairly late in the process of writing this book. The first one is a lecture he gave to MTNA, the Music Teachers National Association, when it met in New York, about education and some of the details that you mentioned of teaching in a room with 100 kids and combining all the third grades in a particular school, to teach them music and the difficulties of actually teaching music in an environment where it was not generally regarded as important is all from that lecture, which was published by the MTNA. The other one that I kind of stumbled upon is a series of about eight or so interviews that a guy named J. Travis Quigg, who was a journalist in 19th century America. He wrote for a periodical called Music, which is a nice vague name. He also wrote for another one. I can't remember where these interviews are published, but there are, I think, eight of them, and I found all eight of them, and they are fabulous because they're interviewing Bristow in the 1888, I think is when they were published. They're, so very late in his life. And Quigg tends, he likes Bristow, and he's asking him all these questions about what it was like to be a young man in New York in the 1840s and doing music and so forth. And so I have a number of, I've mined that material for quotations from Bristow about his experiences over his lifetime, which was absolutely fabulous to have. The other document that I had used in the introduction to the symphony is a 30-page autobiographical sketch that he wrote, I think, in the 1860s. So he would have been about 35 or so. And it was envisioned as a lecture, but I don't think he ever gave it as a lecture. It's just one of these reminiscences that he's talking about growing up in New York City and his early attempts at teaching music. I've already alluded to some of that stuff. He describes himself, which helps because it reveals his kind of droll sense of humor. He wrote a number of piano nocturnes. And every time he wrote, actually it was the other way around. Every time he fell in love with one of his students, he would write a nocturne. And he actually says that I can't remember how many times I fell in love, but I wrote 8 or 10 nocturnes. So it must've been that many times. And some of these nocturnes are the ones that are really so difficult to play, but he describes himself as not particularly good looking. And he was getting ready to go to perform at a concert, and he said that he was okay looking, but there wasn't enough hair up where it's supposed to grow, and the barber made it look so doing premature balding, I guess. So I mean, reading that kind of thing, I'm going, oh, this guy's a real person. He's making, you know, it's coming to life in a way. He also describes in a fair amount of detail what it was like to be the prodigy son of an ambitious New York, American New York composer and performer, a guy, his father, William Bristow, who wanted to make him into this great musician. William Bristow was actually quite a good clarinetist and a teacher and an organist, so we don't know a whole lot about him. But he wanted his son to be the next, I don't know, Mozart. I mean, he named him George Frederick Bristow, right? And in this autobiographical sketch, which I use quite a lot, he writes it all in the third person, and he introduces himself as a member of the Apollo family. And his name, let me see if I can pull this up. His name in this Apollo family is a takeoff on his own name. Let's see, I have a transcript of this thing. Maybe I do. But it's something like George, Ludwig, Wolfgang, whatever. Here, I've got the first page of this thing. Bristow. Our hero of our lecture is of the Apollo family. That is, he had a father whose name was Apollo, and consequently he, the hero, inherited that name. He was a very good musician. He played on the organ, the clarinet, the piano, and so forth. Was an organist in a church. The man composed much sacred music. His greatest hope was that he might have a son who should also become a musician, and a great one. So indeed, his name was Handel, Haydn, Mozart, Beethoven, Apollo.
Wow. That's a lot to live up to. Jeez.
Yes. So I have those documents And that plus all the information that I have from reviews, from commentary, from just little asides in newspaper that say, oh, George Bristow is in town, playing the organ. He, you know, it's the greatest composer in America kind of thing. Those kind of comments that are just thrown off regularly by commentators. They're not trying to, you know, make a point or anything. They're just, you know, identifying him. The other things that I found a number of photographs of him that are in the New York Public Library that were given to the New York Public Library in 2010 by a woman on Long Island who was the, get this, the niece of Bristow's granddaughter, who actually was the source of that autobiographical document as well. I wrote to her when I was working on the Bristow Symphony, and she wrote me a very nice letter. But she had an accordion folder full of photographs and stuff that belonged with the Bristow collection in New York. The majority of Bristow's music is at the New York Public Library in the Performing Arts Library, and it had been given to the New York Public Library by her mother, who was Bristow's granddaughter. No, her aunt, who was Bristow's granddaughter. And these other letters stayed with her. And in 2010, George Bosworth of the New York Public Library made another attempt to get them and secured them for the New York Public Library. And they're a very small cache of letters, but they're wonderful because they provide some, you know, real life information about this man. There are photographs. there are letters that people who knew George Bristow wrote to his wife, his widow, after he died, and they're very candid and talk about him as a great neighbor in Morrisania, and he was the kindest man, and blah blah blah. And there are three letters that he wrote to his daughter, who lived, I don't know where she lived. She lives in New York. And she was in her 30s, was married, had a son who she named George. And these letters, which he's writing from Orient, New York, which is out on Long Island, they had a summer home out there. Three different letters he wrote to her. And they're chatty. And they're full of like, how are you doing? How's your husband? How's your cat? You know, how's Whiskers? How's the little man? You know, and he's clearly a doting grandfather. But I'm pretty sure that she saved these letters because in the last one that we have, which she again wrote from Orient, he's bragging about catching this like 10-pound bluefish off the Orient Point dock, and ha ha ha, your husband, whatever his name is, William, and, you know, he'll be jealous when he hears this kind of stuff. But he gets a little bit pensive toward the end, and he said, you know, here it is, it's already almost in September, Labor Day. It wasn't Labor Day, but Thanksgiving will be around the corner, and Christmas is coming, and then the first of January, et cetera, as they tend to do in the 19th century, you know, ampersand. Well, he never made it to Thanksgiving. He never made it to Christmas or to his birthday, which is on the 19th of December, because he died in early December of a heart attack. And so I'm thinking that probably his daughter, to whom these letters were addressed, kept them because they were so close to the time of his death. But for me as a scholar, as I say in the book, these are the types of things you don't usually include in a biography, a scholarly biography. But they were a little snippet of who the man was. In fact, when I first read these letters, I was sitting in the New York Public Library, and I laughed out loud because he starts out one letter saying, well, it's really hard when there's nothing to say. It's really hard to say it. It's been boring here, and you know the mosquitoes are horrible. And I'm going, yeah, this guy was a real person. So anyway, so I have in the conclusion, I have some quotations from those letters. But that's basically it. It's piecing things together from, you know, from disparate sources and reading between the lines and reading obituaries that some of them don't talk about, you know, the greatest oratorio in American history and his symphonies and so forth, but talk about him as a teacher and what the impact was he had on generations of New York young boys and girls. And they talk about him as a neighbor, not the obituaries, but they talk about him as being a kind and a caring person who was supportive and who never met somebody whose music he couldn't support, you know, that type of thing. And it's just little, a few sentences here and there picked up from all this material that I amassed helped me to create this real person. So you can tell me, was I successful?
Yes. No, I thought you did a good job. I mean, it was pretty clear that you didn't have a lot of personal documents, but you still managed to, as you do in all your books, right? You are so great at finding, a million one-liners and finding a way to put that all together to create sort of a whole. If our listeners listen to read your other books, I mean, in some ways you do that for everyone that you write about, in Opera for the People, for instance, you have so many characters that you've had to do the same thing with, because that is a problem with all American music, really, is that we don't have this large cache of biographical details from almost anyone in 19th century American music. And so thank God for newspaper databases, honestly, because It certainly makes that job a lot easier than it was when you had to hand crank the microfilm to find it. So as we come to the end of this, perhaps I can have one more question about Bristow before we wrap up our interview. You've talked about his music a fair amount, just sort of mentioned different pieces and talked about how he had this reputation as a great American composer. But can you maybe, and in your book, you talk about a lot of individual pieces and really try to give a flavor of what kind of composer he was and what his pieces were like. Obviously, we can't go through all of that. So can you maybe pick one piece that you think is a good representative of Bristow as a composer and just sort of tell us about his style and what kind of, what was distinctive or important about his music?
Well, I'll do the symphony I'm most familiar with, which is the Second Symphony, the Julian Symphony. He was a young man when he wrote this piece, was commissioned, as I mentioned. He was about 25, maybe less than that. He was 53. He was born in 1825, so we can do the math. Anyway, he was young. It was written in the style of early Romantic period composers. Okay, now I should say before I describe this, I should say that as he matured over the course of the 19th century, his music became more like mid-century European composers and late-century European composers. But in this particular piece, he wrote a symphony that is it's absolute music. I tried to find a way. Okay, it's in four movements. There's a rondo, a spectacular, wonderful, dancey rondo, which is actually a scherzo. So it's actually, actually it's not even a scherzo. I said rondo, I meant scherzo. It's not really, it is a scherzo, but unlike being a joke, which is what scherzo means, and that's what Beethoven wrote, and that had replaced the minuet, of course. But it's a dance movement in the symphony, and he wrote a polka. And critics, there's a couple of critics who just went and excoriated him. They said, polka? What the X is this polka stuff? A minuet is a dignified dance. And I'm thinking, he was writing something that appealed to Americans. Americans all danced the polka. It was a very popular style of dance. And everybody knew it. And it's what it went his way within the absolute music style to put a stamp of America on this symphony. So he's making it American because he's using a popular dance in America. It doesn't originate in America. He wrote the slow movement is a very very long adagio with it's a theme and variations essentially, and then the final movement is like a rondo sonata allegro form with a long epilogue, and the epilogue sounds like an anthem, a wind anthem, and I take it as an homage to Julien, who had actually commissioned this work, because Julien did lots of, he came from France, and there was this tradition of French anthems and so forth. I moved heaven and hell to try and find the origin for the tune, and I talked to all sorts of people, couldn't find anything. So maybe he made up the tune for the anthem. This the coda for this composition. One of the things that I need to point out is when I was, before I started working on the Julian Symphony, I had written a book on opera in America in the antebellum period, and I was in the Library of Congress on my sabbatical right after I'd gotten tenure and had written that book, and which was my dissertation, and so on and so forth. And Wayne Shirley, this walking encyclopedia of American music, who was one of the librarians at the Library of Congress, walked up to me one day, and he had in his hand this bound volume, long, like 15 inches long and 8 inches high, of a photostatic copy of Bristow's Julian Symphony. And he said to me, "You know that I am on the committee on the publication of American music. We're creating this multi-volume edition of American music called Music of the United States of America." Being very subtle, a title. "And we need another 19th century symphony. And it should be this symphony by Bristow. And you should be the editor." And I'm going, "Wait a minute, I'm in the middle of something else," but I took it, okay? I took it and I took it home. I mean, this is a document from the Library of Congress. He says, "Take it home." All right, I walk out the door with this document. And it wasn't cataloged. There's a story behind that, but I won't get into. And I brought it home and I put it on my shelf. Okay, so I'm here working on this other book, which actually became Opera for the People. I mean, that was the gestation for that book was like 20 years. But I made the mistake of listening to the only recording of the Julian Symphony, which was done in the 1960s as part of this Society for the Preservation of American Music, or SPAM, recording series. And Louis Kruger, who's a conductor in Europe, in Britain, embarked on this project, and he recorded a number of the Bristow symphonies. One of them was the second. Not a good recording, but he wrote earworms, and I couldn't get them out of my head. You know, I'd be out working in the garden, and I'd, what's going on in my, what am I, oh, that's the second movement of the Bristow symphony. That went on for several years, and I finally agreed to do it. Anyway, the guy knew how to write melodies, and the melodies, and he played with the melodies, and he developed the melodies in a really quite masterful way. He is particularly skillful at writing for winds, and he wrote, I mean, especially in like the polka, there's wonderful quartet for winds, and he does this in a lot of his other pieces as well. The other thing that is really interesting about the Bristow Second Symphony, the Julian Symphony, is that he wrote a major part for trombone. Okay, there aren't very many major parts for trombones in 19th century symphonic music. There were very, very few by the time Bristow wrote this. He was familiar with Schumann's symphonies. He was familiar with Schubert, but barely, because he played these things as in the Philharmonic Society Orchestra. He wrote a masterful solos throughout. I think all of the movements except for the polka have solos for trombone. And the way he plays with them, one of them, he introduces the trombone as a discant to the main theme of the piece. And later, it's the main theme, and so forth. It's the orchestral writing is really quite skillful. Absolutely worthy of people listening to this and knowing it. And the other symphony that has been recorded is the Third Symphony. The Albany Orchestra did a recording of this a number of years ago. I'm hoping that someday someone will record the Fourth Symphony, which is the Arcadian Symphony, which is a nationalistic, programmatic sort of symphony. The Niagara Symphony would be a piece of work because it is, I mean, he was a Beethovenian, so he wrote a choral symphony with full chorus and multi movements, three movements, and then the movements are, anyway, he knew Beethoven's work, and this was his final piece. His music is worth listening to. I think that we're going to get a recording, at least a part of the Mass in C, which is also very much indebted to the Missa Solemnis. Because a scholar who works at Case Western, I think it's a Case Western, a school in Cleveland in any case, who wrote a dissertation on the Mass in C, was supposed to do a performance of it last spring with his choir. And of course it got shut down because of the pandemic. But I'm hoping that eventually we'll get a recording of that. There is a recording of Daniel, the oratorio, which was considered by many American Critics to be the at that time the best American oratorio, and that's made it into the oratorio books by, you know, major scholars of oratorio who say, yeah, this is a gem. So there are, if you like choral music, there's a recording of that, a very good recording of that. Did that answer your question?
Yes, no, absolutely. Thank you so much. Well, as that answer actually indicates, you always have a million projects going on and they're sort of percolating along. So what are you working on right now?
Well, one of the things that I've wanted to do for a while is, I mean, I have for my entire career, I've been very interested in making American musical culture known just to regular Americans. We call it public musicology, as you know. And when I was writing the opera for the People book, it was I was lucky enough to have a fellowship, a year-long fellowship at the National Humanities Center in North Carolina. And we fellows would sit around at lunch and talk about this and that and the other. And there was a lot of discussion at that time about how, you know, we live in the, like, this ivy-colored towers, right, the academy and so forth, and we're so divorced from regular people. We really need to break that down. There's been a lot of discussion about that in the academy for years. And I thought to myself, well, some of the stories I'm telling in this book are really very appealing to a lot of people. And maybe I should make this book into a trade press book, a book that's directed at the popular, you know, general audience. Well, you can't use footnotes in those kinds of books, and you can't use very many of them. And as I've said to you before, I felt that what I was discovering about opera, English language opera in America in the period 1860 to 1900 was filling in such a huge gap in our understanding of American musical culture that I really felt that this needed to be an academic book because people needed to know about it. Scholars needed to know about it. But my compromise with myself was that I would subsequently take some of these chapters and make them into trade press books, general readership books. And so after I finished the Bristol book last summer, which I wrote during my first year of retirement, hooray. it's amazing what you can do when you're not grading papers. I kind of put off doing academic stuff, long-term academic stuff, for a while, and I've just finished writing a prospectus to turn the chapter on Emma Abbott, who was known as America's prima donna, and was this young woman who grew up in Peoria, Illinois, and became this icon. I mean, she grew up as this penniless prairie singer from Peoria, and I love the alliteration. And she died at the age of 41 as a millionaire. She sold English translations of continental opera to the American public as American popular entertainment, and has a fascinating story. And there's, of course, never been anything written about her except for my chapter. And so I've just written a prospectus to try and sell this book to a trade press publisher and write a biography of her. So that's next.
Well, I hope that comes out because, you know, she's an amazing figure and such a character. So I would love to learn more about her for sure. Well, thank you so much for joining me today, Kitty. My name is Kristen Turner, and I've been talking to Catherine Preston about her biography of George Frederick Bristow, published by University of Illinois Press in 2020. Thank you for listening to New Books in Music, a channel on the New Books Network. Thank you so much, Kitty.
Thank you for having me. It's been wonderful.